The views and comments expressed on The Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on The Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
Welcome to The Space Show, 90 minutes of exploring new frontiers and exciting opportunities in outer space. Here's your host, Dr. David Livingston.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Sunday Space Show. Thanks for tuning in, and as I always like to say, it is really great to be here, and it is really great to be here this Sunday, because this has been one heck of an exciting, fabulous week in the private space movement, and that's a large part of what we're going to be talking about today with our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute. But first, telephone numbers and a couple of quick announcements. If you want to call the show and talk to our guest today, Joan Horvath or me, or give us comments, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. And as always, email is dmlivings@yahoo.com or drspace@thespaceshow.com. And special thanks to Lou Gentile and IBC for carrying the show on satellite and on their network. We do appreciate that very much. And also, you can chat with us if you're using Instant Messenger or ICQ. And that screen name, all one word, is Space Show Chat. Also, visit the website, www.thespaceshow.com. This program, as all programs, will be archived there probably sometime tomorrow afternoon, and you can listen to them anytime you want at your convenience. Check out the Space Show store. We will be expanding it soon, so you want to follow that in the newsletter. And also, you can subscribe to the newsletter right there from the website, providing you're not using a spam blocker, as that will prevent you from getting the newsletter, since we do it through a mass mailing project. Otherwise, you can just read it on the website. It is posted to the website as it is being mailed out to all the listeners. And in addition, you'll see a big blue button there that says Support the Space Show. This is a big undertaking to produce and deliver this show to everyone free of charge and all the archive programs. We would certainly appreciate any help and support you can give us to help the Space Show continue on with its mission, which is really to help us all realize a spacefaring culture in this country and around the world. And then one final quick announcement. The three-plus-hour broadcast done on Monday with Spaceship One in Mojave is in the middle of the stages of being edited. We are hoping it will be ready and uploaded to the website tomorrow, Monday. At the latest, it should be there on Tuesday. The newsletter will contain the final update on that, including details on how you can download it or purchase copies of it if you want an actual copy of the program. But it should be there no later than Tuesday. So our guest today, as I said a minute ago, is Joan Horvath, who is CEO of Takeoff Technologies, LLC, and she is also the executive director of Global Space League. She has a 16-year career as a rocket scientist at JPL, which, as you know, is the NASA Center for the Exploration of the Solar System. She has her bachelor's in aeronautics and astronautics from MIT, and she has her master's in mechanical, aerospace, and nuclear engineering from UCLA. When she was at JPL, Ms. Horvath calculated how rocket fuel would flow in space and developed ideas for advanced computers. She played key roles on various real spacecraft, particularly with the Magellan craft to Venus and the Topex Poseidon Earth orbiting spacecraft that measured El Nino phenomenon accurately for the first time. Joan has a special technical interest in finding ways to automate complicated systems in a way that is reliable and cost-effective, and she has authored numerous technical papers as well as being the co-author of a C programming text, and she teaches strategy and technology planning at the Southern California campus of the University of Phoenix. Her interests are in technology and other ideas that are probably best suited to get done outside of JPL. So she, after forming relationships with JPL and toy companies, merchandiser, science fiction producer, she moved her interest outside. And then she created her Takeoff Technologies company, which was launched with an ongoing key contract with the American Film Institute, which is also in Los Angeles. She was recently at Mojave. She was an eyewitness to the Spaceship One launch, to the pre-parties and press conferences on Sunday, to the incredible trains that seem to run through Mojave all the time. So it's really great to have Joan with us and to talk to us about what she saw over at Mojave, what she heard, and all of the other issues that are going to come up today. Welcome to the Space Show, Joan.
Oh, thank you. That was quite an introduction. I was just saying, wow, you know, I have to live up to all that.
Well, tell us about those trains. They seem to be something that you wrote about, right?
Oh, well, Mojave was really born as a borax train switching center, and they still run all night, and so we were camped out in the Motel 6 up there, and I didn't discover until I checked in that it was right next to the train tracks.
Since Spaceship One seems to be on everyone's mind, and it was such an incredible event, let's just start in with Spaceship One. Tell us what you saw and what you thought and what the people around you were thinking and experiencing, if you can do that.
Well, the wonderful part was I was a member of the press for this purpose because I did a piece in Scientific American where I did have the opportunity to interview Bird and Paul Allen. That piece is back in the April issue. And I'm expanding the ideas in that into a book, and so I was able to be one of, what I gather, is 600 accredited press. And from our community's point of view, one of the very exciting things about this is that they were all what we would call, in double quotes, all the mainstream press was there. All the networks were there. I counted 16 sound trucks at 3:45 in the morning, and they were coming in like, you know, wagon trains into the war zone or something. And the folks who were not used to our community were very eager to understand what the dynamics were and what the issues were. And so I think that's a very good thing. That you have the financial press fairly significantly represented there, and they were not there. They were not there to write, boy, isn't this ridiculous stories. They were there to write, is this a new industry stories? And I think that's a very exciting thing for us. And I think everybody in that press contingent was astonished by how small those vehicles were because people aren't used to that. And the fact that when they took off, the thing rumbled down the runway, preceded by one of their little tiny chase planes, and hung out at the end of the runway and took off, and that was it. And I think the sheer lack of apparent fuss of all that was a very powerful thing for these folks also.
What was your highlight of the Mojave experience? Was it the takeoff? Was it the announcement that Spaceship One had reached the right altitude? What was your highlight?
I think my personal highlight was the spaceship was on the ground because Spaceship One lands first along with its chase planes, and we're all kind of minding our own business and waiting for them to sort it out and tow the Spaceship One back in front of the press area for a statement by the pilot, and of all things, White Knight comes in, and that's a kind of neglected almost in some ways and very interesting aircraft. And it comes in and it comes over the runway the wrong way to land. And I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. And then what he does is pour on the power and go straight up. Just a sheer, you know, isn't this great? I can do this air show kind of thing to do. And I can't imagine that ever happening at any NASA event. And so I think just seeing that thing, The person on the PA system said very dryly, as you'll note, it has rather a lot of power when it doesn't have a spaceship hanging underneath it.
When it was doing its climb to 45,000 feet to release Spaceship One, could you keep it in view all the time? Did you lose the view of it? Could you hear it?
No, you really couldn't see much anything. They occasionally put out a little bit of airshow smoke so you could see it. And, of course, people were wandering around with binoculars, you know, trying to see it. And the actual launch you could definitely see. That was quite spectacular because it went across the sun, so the contrail was backlit. And it was very difficult to photograph and to get the feel of how very impressive that was, just because of the limitations of commercial cameras. But you know, it was quite something to see that across the sun and understand what it was.
I do want to direct people to the article that you wrote on our friend Clark Lindsay's incredible website, hobbyspace.com, and it's right there on the front page if all of you go and visit, and you'll see Joan's article about her eyewitness experience at Mojave. It is certainly worth your reading, and great pictures, and Clark does a great job of keeping current with everything, and so go check it out. I know you will enjoy reading it. Did you get a chance to, did the press get a chance to meet with the pilot or with Bert or with Paul Allen?
Well, they had a press conference on Sunday afternoon, which was so large that they had a lot of us out in a tent and able to ask questions through a microphone system. And a tent outdoors in Mojave at 3 in the afternoon is a little interesting. And I think I drank about 4 quarts of water when I got back to the room that night. And they had the same setup the next day. So, you know, the press who were representing very large organizations, I presume, were inside and we were outside. But even so, you know, just to see that thing land and see Mike Melville climb out and to see it all at very close range. You know, it's something a lot of us have been wanting to see for very many years, and just to see it actually happen now, I think is going to change our industry quite a bit.
What kind of feedback have you been hearing during the week since his flight? Or have you been getting calls, emails, seeing things that give an indication that this is maybe shaking things up, changing the space movement, changing people's perception of space?
Well, the exciting thing for us is I'm helping the city of Frederick, Oklahoma, put together what we're calling the CAPS Space Science Center, which is named after Senator CAPS, as some of you know. State Senator CAPS some years ago decided that he would try to attract entrepreneurial aerospace to Oklahoma, and Oklahoma has really gotten themselves behind this. And so there are several sites in Oklahoma that are looking at flying vehicles to space, and one of them is Frederick, and Frederick is particularly focusing on vertical launch. And we have a little airship company that we put out there about a year ago that is starting to do quite nicely now. And about a week ago, Beyond Earth Enterprises, which is currently in Colorado Springs, announced they're going to move their launches there. And so for us, the timing was wonderful because a lot of folks we've talked to about sponsorship and about investment and all that kind of thing. Tuesday, my phone rang so much that I don't think I made it through any call without my call waiting beeping.
Interesting.
And that's a good thing. That's a very good thing. And, you know, so I've been just running at 100 miles an hour all week, working with the folks in Frederick, looking at there might be some other folks that might be interested in coming out there that are scattered around the country and having difficulty finding some place to fly, and working those issues and trying to do good urban planning at the same time.
What I find interesting about Frederick, as well as other space news coming out of Oklahoma, is I am an Oklahoman. I'm from Tulsa, and my first year of college was at OU before I transferred to the University of Arizona. And I still have a lot of relatives and family in Tulsa, and I'm back there with business interests. And all the years and all my experience in my whole life in Oklahoma, space was never part of the Oklahoma culture. Tulsa had the American Airlines Maintenance Center, but aviation like that is not anything to do with space. It had the old Douglas plant there for military stuff. And for the war, it had Spartan aircraft. But again, space was not on the horizon. And growing up with the Apollo program and everything, Oklahoma just wasn't in that equation. We followed space like everybody else did in the country. And then, wow, something happened in Oklahoma maybe 8-9 years ago to change its culture and its mentality to, at a state level, really go after the space industry and the private space industry. And it's an amazing transformation for me to see the commitment of resources and efforts that Oklahoma and communities like Fred Frederick have made to become space centers. I mean, it's hard for me to understand it.
It's an interesting cultural situation. One of the things that I've been doing is to try to look at similar periods in history, partly because I need material for my graduate students who are theoretically all out there listening, but also to say, all right, what models have worked to build essentially an industry from nothing in the past? Obviously, Mojave is succeeding because they have that deep pool from Edwards Air Force Base, which for people who aren't local is just to the south there. And so there's an enormous tradition there, a huge pool of folks to draw upon. And Mojave itself is pretty isolated, but it's not really very far from Lancaster, Palmdale, and particularly Edwards. And so they have that. So I consciously said when I was approached by Frederick to help them do this, what don't they have? And one of the things they don't really have is good connectivity, or didn't have, to the outside world, and particularly some technical depth. And so the model we're using is to say, all right, a lot of these little companies desperately need some technical help. They might be very strong in one area or another. They also need business help, but we'll get there later. And so an obvious source for me as a former JPL program manager type person was to say, well, let's find some universities that are in places that have a deep pool of people who can be helpful, who can help do some things, and also who understand how to spin out to technology businesses. And so Santa Clara University, I've had a long-standing relationship with, and they're a very interesting, very innovative university that is very comfortable working with new, very young businesses. And so they really, in many ways, have helped get this started. By forming some relationships with, particularly with our airship company. And also by the fact that if you have a relationship with a university in Silicon Valley, that raises your credibility with folks in Silicon Valley and all the things that can spool out of that. And so, we're really looking at our CAPS Space Science Center as being a center where companies that maybe are at very early stage can come in and say, all right, we have some ideas. We don't have everything we need. We understand that, which is, I always say, is the first step of the entrepreneur's 12-step program, actually getting money. And so, how can we work with the folks that are already here? And I think that model has worked pretty well. The folks in Frederick are amazing people. I like to say that Frederick is an entrepreneurial company masquerading as a little city.
I have an email note from, John, and he says, why do you believe, actually it's on chat, so he's still connected so he can continue the dialogue. Why do you believe Frederick, Oklahoma can be a major space center in the future? What is the infrastructure that is being developed to help it do this?
That's a very good question. I think all the other spaceport candidates to date have made a mistake. And the mistake is that they have built infrastructure on the camp, without necessarily knowing what kind of business is going to come in, without worrying about that a lot. And our philosophy is that we will form relationships among people. We will get very good, very strong people to help with the business part, with the technology part, and then we will finance purely commercially any infrastructure that needs to get built.
How easy is it to finance this infrastructure in Oklahoma?
Well, what you really need is a nationwide network of people. You have to be able to point to experienced people on the financial side. We've been fortunate to attract the Silicon Valley retired hedge fund manager to help us understand how to structure these things, and that's been an enormous help to us. And frankly, you know, a lot of it is going to be timing and luck. I think one of the things Bert has said over and over is that one of the things he wanted to accomplish with this flight is to create credibility for the industry so that other folks could look at him and say, hey, he did it, so, you know, these other folks can too. And so I think that's a lot of it at the moment.
What's the support like, as well as the workforce like in Oklahoma? Can it support the technology and the requirements and goals that you're helping to put in place?
I think it's in good shape out there because there are three Air Force bases of pretty decent size, or one Army base in Fort Sill, and two pretty significant Air Force bases at Altus and Wichita Falls, none of which are particularly far away. And so, you know, if once this thing gets going a little bit more, we do have those pools to draw upon. And Frederick itself, I was doing an interview for one of the larger papers that covers a regional paper down there, and I asked the reporter what she thought about, you know, what did people think about this, her comment was that you know, everybody just was going to wait and see is pretty much the attitude out there. So I think the pool is there. Lawton, Oklahoma is about 45 miles to the northeast, and it has Fort Sill, which is a very large Army installation. And it's 130,000 people. So that's not a small community to draw on. And Wichita Falls is larger and a little bit farther away to the south.
It also had a great pizza parlor that I owned that we sold because the soldiers at Fort Sill didn't support it the way we thought it was going to support it. That was that was about 6 years ago. So just an interesting little tidbit from this Okie who knows Lawton quite well. I have a note on email from Ford, and he is in Enid, which is also in western Oklahoma out toward the Panhandle. And he says, please explain the difference with Burns Flat and Clinton Sherman Air Force Base and Frederick's. I know Oklahoma has a push to work with the space community, but I've not followed it that closely. The Spaceship One launch brought me to the attention of this show today, and I have been confused as to what actually is happening with Oklahoma spaceports, given that I keep reading about Clinton Sherman, Burns Flat, and Frederick's. Can you help explain this to me?
Well, I think they're complementary sites. In the early studies, Frederick was an alternate site. And I think the focus at Burns Flat, Pioneer, I should call them Rocket Plane Limited now, did get a large tax grant some tax relief to relocate from California out to there. And a lot of the things out there are focused around vehicles that take off and land like airplanes, and that's due to the nature of the airspace up there and a variety of other things. What we're trying to do in Frederick is to take companies that are much younger. We're not getting any money from the state at this time. And we are trying to do a purely commercial model in which we set up a company to operate the spaceport. We're looking right now and have a meeting July 5th down there to decide, or at least to lay out all the issues of what that entity can look like. And in an ideal world, I would like that entity to be a purely private entity. That may not be pragmatic just for liability reasons and other things. And so rather than a state facility, we're looking at this much more being a small private facility that is aimed at folks doing very early stage experimentation. And I have a 501c3 nonprofit down there that David alluded to called Global Space League. And what Global Space League does is it gets kids subscribed to competing for opportunities to put their science experiments on board these early test flights. And so we're able to take that subscription money and to support some early stage flight tests. And so that model has also worked out quite well for us.
I have an interesting email note from Susan, who is in Chicago, and it's a bit of a change of subject, but we're coming up on our first break, so we might as well put this one out here right now. Susan in Chicago says, the Aldrich Committee has recommended closing 5 NASA centers to have them managed and developed more like what JPL does with NASA. Since you were with JPL for many years, what do you think about that idea and recommendation?
I think they should do it with all of them. I really enjoyed my time at JPL. My program hit a stage where it made sense to spin it out, but that was not an easy decision for me. And I think the structure that JPL has is a good one, and I think is a healthy one. And again, it's Caltech runs JPL, for folks who don't know that. And I think having universities run the NASA centers would really change their style and make them more like our Global Space League entity in Frederick.
Now, Caltech is a private school. Do you think it makes a difference if it's a private school running it or a public university?
I think having it be a private school, and of course Caltech's a special case because it's a private school with a large endowment, and that gives them rather a lot of freedom in being able to do big things that maybe a smaller school could not. And whether, you know, a state university system would make sense, you know, I think it's really a case-by-case thing. It depends on the style of the school, how much freedom the school has to do things. I mean, the last thing you want to do is add another layer of bureaucracy, right?
Absolutely. And with that comment, we are going to take our first break on the Space Show with our guest today, Joan Horvath. Stay where you are on the computer, on the dial, and we will be right back.
The Space Show would like to take a moment to thank each of you for listening and giving this program both praise and support. The Space Show, like other talk radio programs, depends upon advertisers and sponsors for their help and financial support. Tell your favorite business about the great advertising opportunities still available on The Space Show. Our ad packages are affordable, creative, and effective. They include web links and advertising, streaming internet play, as well as our very own internet radio station, in combination with your ad, on the Tuesday evening KKNW Seattle Space Show broadcast. Ad packages can be customized to fit your budget, and we know that we can have a positive impact on your business. For more information about advertising or sponsoring the Space Show, call Dr. Livingston at 415-435-6018 or send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com. The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all mankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, economy, and our cosmic vision. One in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility in our off-Earth conduct and the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the reality of tomorrow.
And welcome back to the Sunday Space Show. I am your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Joan Horvath. Joan, do you think that Spaceship One had a significant impact on the administration, on NASA, and maybe even the participants of the Aldrich Committee report?
Well, it's always hard to tell. You know, they're in kind of a tough spot because right now, I've been circulating some talking points around to various scientists, friends of mine, trying to see how we can meet them halfway. You know, when I was in the program office, it's very, very hard to make sudden left turns because a lot of NASA programs are, by necessity, 10 and 15 years long because some of these things are pretty hard to do and are going to be hard for our community to do for a while, like large telescopes, for instance. So having said that, What we need to do is to find some nice niches where we can get some business for smaller things. And so I've been trying to help people understand at the working scientist level within NASA what there is and what the realities are. And we've been scratching our heads a little to let, for instance, a scientist who is proposing to one of the programs that has spacecraft small enough to fly on some of these, to have as an option taking a lower cost and frankly taking more risk. And so we're trying to think of some ways to do that.
I have another note from John, who is on chat still with us from Montana, and he wants to know if Spaceship One will create a sort of investment bubble for small commercial space companies. How do you envision universities and commercial space companies working together? Sort of a two-part question.
Well, on the bubble part, I hope so. It would be nice. On the second question, there's a lot of experience in various parts of the country, particularly in California and Massachusetts, because of universities that are comfortable with this, and Texas, I should say, as well, in having universities take equity in small companies in exchange for technology, and having universities co-invent and share in some of the profits of that. And if you're a little itty-bitty company and you have a very large university partnering with you, that I think gives investors warm fuzzies. And, warm fuzzies plus a bubble is sort of a nice mix to maybe sort of mix metaphors there very strangely.
Do you think that there's a lot of competition with the Oklahoma space activities and Frederick's or the other spaceports with what is going on in other states that are trying to get commercial spaceports going on too? Do you think there's enough business for them all, or how do you see that unfolding?
Well, I think a few models will emerge. I think a couple of state spaceports will emerge who are focused on doing large projects and maybe having one anchor tenant and on having a fair amount of mixed private and government money coming into those companies. I think I would like to think that Mojave and Frederick are a somewhat different model. And I can't speak for Mojave, but speaking for Frederick, what we're really, really trying to do is to create a place where entrepreneurs can be left alone and get as much help as they want. And where there are other folks who are like-minded that can work with them, but there is not a lot of public money that has been poured into facilities there, and therefore there isn't that feeling that something has to happen right away. What you can do is let the companies build at their own pace, supported by the nonprofit, supported by early customers, and build it the way that actually most tech businesses have been built, if you go back in the history of any tech business.
Your company, Takeoff Technologies, is an effort that bridges science and entertainment. I'm interested in exploring the relationship of the type of space development that we've been talking about on the program today and the entertainment industry. What can you say about that? Is there a keen interest? Are you trying to develop an interest? Is it a different interest than what entertainment likes to do with space?
Well, we have good relationships in a variety of places right now, and there are some things we're trying to pull together. I think a good way to characterize it is that Takeoff was originally founded to try to feed toy companies and entertainment companies and things like that with scientific accuracy consulting. And it turned out that as soon as I came out moved away from doing that from JPL, our most famous product at JPL was Mattel's Toy Mars Rover, which was quite the bestseller. But anyway, a lot of the entrepreneurial space folks started calling me up and saying, well, can you do what you did for Sojourner for us? And I said, you know, usually the first question was, who the heck are you? Which wasn't a good question to be asking in that context. And so I think a lot of what we're doing and what we're trying to do by bringing companies into what I hate to call an incubator, but it's getting called that a lot down in Frederick, is to give them some of that connectivity, to help train them up a little bit about what needs to happen before any entertainment company will be interested in them, and things like that.
Do you think the entertainment industry has an interest in the serious type of space that we've been talking about, or is the entertainment version of space so vastly different that it's hard for them to see a connection to what we're talking about?
Well, as a wise producer friend of mine is always batting me over the head, he said, you can make anything interesting if you can tell a good story. And one of the things the entertainment industry is good at is telling stories. And so one of the things we've been trying to do is to excite some folks who are professional storytellers, and we're very good at it. It's a specialty just like building rocket engines, and a lot of folks don't understand that in our industry. And to get some of those good storytellers together and to help them tell a story. And if you're telling a good story, you can be telling a good story about a scientist who is launching a 2-pound payload on a small rocket, or you can tell a story about the first space tourist. And if you're a good storyteller, in the right hands, those are both equally valid projects.
Do you, how hard was it to get the kind of quality board and advisors that you have for Takeoff? They're listed on your website, and I'm not going to read the names, but I will tell people that it's a very impressive group of people. So for a company starting up in space, that's really what I'm after. How challenging is it, how difficult is it to get the type of advisory board that you have been able to secure?
Well, I think one of the things that was important about us both on Global Space League and on Takeoff, both of which have interesting boards, is that we didn't really tie ourselves to a vehicle so much. We tied ourselves to what I'll call a program. And the point of the program is to make, certainly in Frederick, space much more accessible for university academics and for students. And as part of that, because we're focused on that customer base, the folks who are very early stage in building smaller things are very attractive to us. So we're going at this market-driven, and there are a lot of folks out there right now who would like to have access to space and who can't. And so we have those interesting boards because first of all, for the couple of entertainment folks on Takeoff's board, because in the long run, they would like to see more accurate science in film. And on the more customer scientist side, they'd like to be able to weld a fly stuff, and in many cases they can't. So I think we've been fairly eclectic. A lot of folks were, the program I had at JPL was canceled, and a lot of folks were associated with that and moved over to our board.
Do you think the entertainment industry would ever see the day where films could actually be made in space, or would the special effects and simulations always be cheaper and more usable than actually doing a real space-based movie or special effects in space?
Well, it all comes down to cost. And if the cost falls, there have been a couple of space station projects. It was a space station, I believe, IMAX movie. And you've probably seen that.
Yes, I have. It's a great movie.
For instance, and that obviously was a big deal to do. And so it all comes down to cost. I ask that question of producers all the time, and they always tell me, if we can get the cost down, we'll do something. And right now, the cost is prohibitive, and you're dealing with, a very difficult situation for getting anything filmed up there. And, I think it's a lot of it will be, can we bring costs down? Can you film without people? Is there going to be a time when robotic cameras will be good enough for a producer? And those are some of the questions.
Do you think that Spaceship One is actually bringing in an era where the cost of space for getting humans up there is going to drop substantially, or are we still a long way from realizing anything close to that?
Well, I would like to think so. I think the main thing that will happen out of this is that that the people will be more comfortable investing. They will not be so dubious about the whole thing. And I think that's the critical thing, because there's some very interesting things out there. Our industry, unfortunately, has a lot of very dubious companies in it. And, you know, it's going to take a while for the market to sort out the good companies and the dubious companies. And I think an important thing will be good assets to help investors with diligence and things like that.
And in having reviewed and still doing it, many business plans for entrepreneurial companies, dubious is a kind word, Joan.
So, I was being nice, yes.
So we can just kind of leave it at that and go on to the next thing. To become truly spacefaring and to see this industry take off, it certainly is a bigger picture than just what the United States can do alone. So I have on this show brought this up to the very strong, loudly yelling space advocates that we can do everything and all of these grand company designs are going to work. And I just say one magic word, including those that propose the space elevator, and that magic word is ITARS. So it is a subject I talk about frequently. I know that that you have knowledge about it. Is ITARS really going to rear an ugly head and stop some of this economic growth and possibility right in its tracks? Is it something to not be concerned about from your perspective?
Oh, it's probably the number one issue for these little companies. A small company can't afford the legal assistance to, for instance, take a foreign investor. A small company has to be very paranoid about what they say. And I think unless there's some ITAR relief, I will predict that the Brits and Japanese will own this business, maybe in the Russians, in 10 years.
And that would
all of it, not just the little stuff.
And that could be as well for the entertainment industry or any component of expanding space commerce, correct?
Yeah, because it's a very difficult situation, partly because things are so poorly defined. And, you know, you get in this position where the rules are so draconian and the penalties are so extreme and personal that people are afraid to say anything. And, I must confess that I'm even a little nervous to say anything. And it bothers me most of all that I live in the United States and I am concerned about saying anything about a U.S. policy on open radio. And I think the fact that that's true bothers me more than anything else. And I think a lot of people are very afraid to say anything about ITAR on the record. And what to do about it, I don't know. If I knew that.
Well, Joan, at least you're not using any bad language where Michael Powell will come down on us. So think of the bright side.
I guess.
I will say this, because I don't care if I say something on the air. My brother and I just recently sold my mother's condominium in nearby in Northern California. And I was stunned when we had to go through various Patriot Act requirements in escrow on the sourcing and the allocation and identification and identity of the owners in order to complete the transaction. And the title company was telling us these are all new requirements for, doing any kind of a real estate transaction vis-a-vis the Patriot Act. And then, you know, I'm a real estate broker, and I don't do it anymore, I'm inactive, but I called the other title companies and asked them if all of this was going on because I'm sort of out of the question. And yeah, there, you know, all these documents and things that we had to go through selling mom's unit to comply with the Patriot Act, which to me is just amazing. And you know, ITARs, you know, are certainly more powerful and more, you know, long ranging in their impact on space business. But yeah, as an American, things are really changing, you know, to say the least. And it's going to be interesting, I think, to see if the space business and the demand for it can pressure and overcome some of these barriers and obstacles that probably only exist when the people don't know about them or not enough people care about them to raise a voice. And I don't know if enough people will speak out to where changes can be made. I just, you know, it's hard to imagine how some of these barriers are going to get crossed. But I know this is a real problem.
Right now, everybody just deals with it by being scrupulously careful and staying, you know, staying extremely cautious. You know, makes absolutely sure that nobody does anything that crosses any of these lines. And I think just, you know, the fact that you have to worry about that so much.
Well, I know for Space Elevator, that would probably not be constructed in the United States. It would be off in the Pacific Ocean someplace or maybe on a mountaintop in Ecuador. None of this American technology is ever going to get there. And so, you know, I guess the U.S. will either just be left out of it if it's all done with Japanese and European or maybe Chinese technology and money. But unless something changes, it's doubtful that it's going to be done with anything American. And I think that's pretty depressing when you look at the broad picture and the future that we have that we could benefit from with space.
Well, Surrey spacecraft, bless them, is out there in Guildford, England, is, you know, has squarely cornered the emerging countries market. By working with the Russians to launch and, you know, and by being accessible. And, you know, I don't see that trend changing.
No, but maybe with enough pressure and enough success and an actual X Prize winner, which it certainly looks like it's going to be BERT, you know, things will change. And I've been thinking lately, and I wonder what your thoughts are on this. If for some reason BERT did not win the X Prize, and the most likely candidates after Spaceship One are probably the Canadian companies, what do you think the impact on our space policy and regulatory environment and financial things would be if a Canadian team won the X Prize?
I don't think that it will matter much, frankly, because I think the folks that track this closely are not folks that would be impacted by that much, if you see what I mean. You know, I think it will be a blip on the public radar screen, and then it will carry on. And so, unfortunately, I think that that's true. The old saying was that support for space is a mile wide and a quarter of an inch deep, and that's a lot of the trouble right now, is that the general public, which also includes, you know, most legislators and folks like that, you know, are mildly interested in all this, but there are only a handful of them that really have spent the time to understand or have staffers who have, and, you know, and understand the impacts. And so I think there'll be a brief hue and cry, and then things will kind of go on. I'd like to think differently, but unfortunately I think that's the case.
So you don't think it would be a huge national wake-up call on the order of when Russia launched Sputnik and caught us all by surprise?
No, I think if an Eastern European or the Russians won it, then I think that would be different. But, you know, I think the Canadians are sort of close enough family that would not have, it wouldn't have the same impact. I think if the Canadians or the Brits won, I don't think that would be as much of a kind of a national shock as it would be as, you know, the Chinese won, say. And I think that would be a real curveball, and I think that might have some impact. But I think you know, if a NATO country wins, it's just not going to be quite the same panic factor.
You visually saw Spaceship One and White Knight. If you had the opportunity to ride in it, would you do it?
Well, it's sort of a funny question, and people who know me are probably rolling on the floor right now because I'm a very nervous flyer, and I get airsick on almost all 737s going out of LAX on the turn. So for pragmatic reasons, I probably wouldn't because I'd get so sick, but I like to think about it.
So the reason why you might not would be because you're susceptible to being air sickness, not because you would doubt the technology or the quality of the space ride.
No, I actually was sitting there thinking about it at the time. It's like, boy, you know, if they hung out the window right now, waved and, you know, pointed at the seat and said, surprise, surprise, we're taking a member of the press, you know, what would I do? And I don't know. It would be awfully tempting. It'd be awfully tempting, but I'd really need a brown bag.
Well, they may have been providing those. I don't know.
I don't know.
Did you think that most people around you, when you saw the flight, would be willing to go? Did you hear any like negative chatter or wow, I'd never ride on anything like that, or oh God, I wish it were me going up there?
Well, working press, particularly at that hour of the morning, are much more focused on making sure they're kind of ready to write things down or mechanically dragging cables and things. And so, you know, since I think it would probably have been different in the public area, but in the press area, people were very, very focused on getting things to work. And as somebody who has to get an assortment of equipment at your end working before you go on the air, I'm sure you can appreciate that. And so it was much more, how are we going to do this kind of feel. And then once people got settled, then they started chatting. But as I said, I found myself and actually fairly deliberately parked myself in with some business press. And so they were much more interested in the, how many more like this are there at home kind of thing. You know, is this the only guy? Are there more? How many more? Kind of questions.
Do you think Frederick could one day be another Mojave?
Well, I'd like to think that. I mean, we're focused on vertical launch because they're very, and, you know, we still have not worked with the FAA in any kind of detail. We've looked at this in general principles. We're certainly not even at the point of having filed anything formal with the FAA yet. So we need to work out with them how to do this. So having said all that, I it's a little bit different. Mojave is a flight test center, and so it's focused on flight testing things. What we're trying to do in Frederick is more focused on users who need, for scientific and educational purposes, low-cost rides to the upper atmosphere and space. And so we're almost more of a university consortium aimed at the scientist user end. And the fact that a good provider of all of that kind of service is a young flight company is part of the is a secondary part almost in some ways. But we're trying to create a pool of customers for these young companies, and we figure a pool of customers is a very good thing.
Do you have a timeline that allows you to gauge the success and the road that you are on with your work in Frederick, and can you share any of the timeline objectives or goals and when they might be coming to fruition?
Well, the little airship company we have up there, High Ships, has done nicely. As I've said, he's been laying very low for a year and working with Santa Clara, like all good early-stage tech companies should do. And I think we're now at a stage where we'll be able to demonstrate some things there and hopefully take some scientific payloads along on some of those tests under the Global Space League umbrella. We're just starting our relationship with Beyond Earth, and the fact that we have those two assets, as it were, out there makes it much easier for me to now go to some of our more scientific-oriented partners and say, okay, you know, here is what we have now, and, you know, here are some possible sources of funds. Now, what science would you like to do? And so that's been a lot of the discussion in the last week. And depending on how rapidly some of that grant money comes together or private investment will drive in part what those timetables are. I would like to see five little companies out there in a couple of years. That would make me, that's a nice number. That's a sustainable number. Maybe one or two lighter than air companies and three rocketry companies. That would be a good thing.
And if I know you have projects for students to fly projects and experiments, and we're coming up on another break right about at the top of the hour, but how do you open that up for students? How do they find out about it? What are the requirements? How do the students get to do a project or an experiment?
Well, they can go to our website, which is globalspaceleague.org, and you can click on some of our activities there. We're about to change model slightly, and so I would refer people there. To date, what we've done is in principal schools subscribe, but no school has actually subscribed. They've all been sponsored. We found that companies are very comfortable sponsoring a school. It's $150 for a school. And what we are looking at is we're looking at a couple of different models that we'll have on our website in a little bit.
Okay. Great place to take a pause. We will be back with our guest today, Joan Horvath, in just a few short minutes. Stay right where you are.
The Space Show would like to take a moment to thank each of you for listening and giving this program both praise and support. The Space Show, like other talk radio programs, depends upon advertisers and sponsors for their help and financial support. Tell your favorite business about the great advertising opportunities still available on The Space Show. Our ad packages are affordable, creative, and effective. They include web links and advertising, streaming internet play, as well as our very own internet radio station, in combination with your ad, on the Tuesday evening KKNW Seattle Space Show broadcast. Ad packages can be customized to fit your budget, and we know that we can have a positive impact on your business. For more information about advertising or sponsoring The Space Show, call Dr. Livingston at 415-435-6018 or send an email to drspace@thespaceshow.com.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality.
And welcome back to The Space Show. This is your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Joan Horvath. Again, if you would like to call and talk to Joan, pick up the phone, and it is toll-free, 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners. Let it ring until we can answer it, and you are on the air. And chat, again, if you're using Instant Messenger or ICQ, is all one word, Space Show Chat. And email dmlivings@yahoo.com or drspace@thespaceshow.com. Joan, if we can go back to the Spaceship One experience. As you know, I had John Carter McKnight there in Mojave with a cell phone, and we streamed it live for 3+ hours. And I was in the hotel in Santa Barbara, running the streaming side of the show, and I was getting emails from all over the world, including here in America, from people listening to the program and crashing the server and trying to find alternative streaming links. But I got one note from a person, and I forget which European country he is from, and I saved the email, but he was talking about how fabulous this was, and he said, "You Americans don't know what you have here, and you don't know how to capitalize on it and how to develop it and how to nurture it. But this is an incredible treasure for America, not just for Bert and Paul Allen." And he went on talking about the impact of this and what people in his country, in his community, were saying about the ability of a private company to be able to do this with private financing. Do you think that there's any truth to that? Do you think we're sort of, as a community here in America, not really understanding or appreciating what Spaceship One truly means?
Well, I don't know. I certainly know that my next door neighbors just got home from a family vacation to Germany, and they knew that I was up in Mojave, and so they kind of pounded over here to see, you know, to get the firsthand view, and they said that it had been covered very well there, and that they were kind of bummed that they'd not had a chance to take the kids up there. But you know, I think folks here understand an emerging tech industry. I think that space has not been perceived as an emerging tech industry really until Monday, at least judging from the kinds of responses I'm getting and phone calls that are getting returned now that weren't before. And so I think that's a lot of where this will go next, which is kind of your implicit question, I think.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, where it'll go next will really depend on how many decent companies emerge. I think there'll be some consolidation. I think a lot of companies are out there all trying to do entire vehicles by themselves, which is, I think, is a little silly. And I think there'll be some consolidation and some companies that are good at piece X and there'll be some that are good at piece Y, you know, might be encouraged by investors to merge. And I think that will be the next wave.
There's a lot of other companies in Mojave that are trying to launch rockets, building technology for this. When you were there, did you get a chance to see any of the other companies? Were there people in the press area? Did you get a chance to talk to them and find out what the greater suborbital community was feeling and expressing about Spaceship One's success?
Well, X-Corps, who are just down the line there, threw a very marvelous party for the duration, for which I think everyone's grateful. And so, you know, and I've known the X-Corps folks for a long time and worked with them quite a bit. And so the a lot of my view comes from hanging out there. And I think the night before, I think everybody was a little worried and a little cautious because, you know, here was a very public, aggressive flight test, and everybody in that community understands what that means and that things can go wrong. Actually, I have a lot of honorary nieces that are about 11 and 12, and, you know, I talked to one or two parents about, would you like me to bring them, you know, and watch? And the answer in one case was no, because, you know, I'm afraid that he'll crash and I think she won't be able to handle that. And that was fair enough. So I think there's a combination of jubilation and a little bit of worry the night before. Because everybody knew that, I think, by then that, you know, the industry was going to be in trouble if anything really bad happened. But, you know, I mean, afterwards, certainly the world is different and we all bought t-shirts and I think everyone will go forward on that.
John brings up a good point in his chat, and that is about how our society as a whole is becoming risk-averse, and also how we like to emphasize, especially in the corporate and the financial world, short-term goals and results and returns on investment rather than anything having to do with long-term planning. So the first part of my question, following up on what John has said, did you ascertain any apprehension in the crowd that you were with regarding the potential risk of the pilot, Mike Melville, for Spaceship One? Did risk seem to enter into the picture, or the danger seem to enter into the picture?
Well, I imagine that the risk is a lot of what made 600 Crespi there, if we're all honest about it. I mean, the fact that, you know, here's this guy, he's going to go out and risk his life is a lot of the energy behind that story. And, you know, and he's a very brave guy, and I hope he gets, you know, the long-term place in history he deserves, and it's not a footnote. So I think, you know, certainly one of our biggest problems ongoing and perpetual is insurance. You know, some of our things we're looking at flying are tiny and weigh a couple of pounds, and I have to worry about, well, you know, how worried do I have to be about this thing? And, you know, a rational answer in a rational world would be, you know, if a piece of styrofoam lands on somebody's head, they should shake the styrofoam bits out of their hair. But unfortunately, that's not the world we live in.
Well, you're living in the financial and the business world with space. So let's talk about our focus in this country on short-term results rather than on R&D and longer-term investments, where longer-term will just surely, you know, keep an investor away, because everything has to be, you know, 3, 5, 7 years, something like that. How big an issue is this for the space world?
Well, a lot of the issues are a little more fundamental in that a lot of the companies don't have business plans that involve customers. And so it's hard to show a return that, you know, if you don't have a really good solid business plan that talks about who you're going to sell your service to. And so I think those issues will start to go away, because certainly there are certainly people who invest in pretty long term, you know, pick your favorite industry, telecom or something. And it's not that much farther out. And so, you know, the internet was built on private money. And if you think about it, once you got past the initial government chunk of change. And, you know, there's a lot of dark fiber out there still and will be for a long time, and people are okay with that. So I think there's a similar issue here, and I think mostly it reflects the fact that people haven't really had solid business plans.
This is an email question from Sally in Austin, Texas, and she says, I have read quite a few press reports about the Spaceship One launch, and I've heard many commentators, but I haven't heard anyone address this issue. Did your guests see or hear that anyone from the large aerospace companies like Lockheed and Boeing were represented at Mojave?
Well, I was in the press area, so, you know, by nature of things, I wouldn't have seen them. I would imagine, given that, you know, there are all kinds of aerospace activities in Palmdale, which is not very far, I would assume that a lot of those folks turned out. You know, but again, I was in the press area, and so, you know, that isn't naturally the folks I would cross paths with.
I did ask John Mark Carter McKnight on our broadcast about that, and he said he didn't recognize space advocates in the visitors area where he was, nor did he recognize or see any indication that the aerospace industry had people in the visitors section. So he would have been looking for a T-shirt that said Boeing, or, you know, some indication that somebody was associated with that, and he didn't see it. And he thought it was a good sign that he saw only new faces and not the familiar space advocate, space conference attendees, so that this event was reaching a lot of new people and different people. But, you know, I would like to know if the aerospace industry was represented there and what they thought. If anybody out there has any feedback on that, please send it to me by email. I'd certainly like to, you know, to get caught up and to hear about that. What do you think is going to be in store for the private sector for space through the balance of this year? Because already it's been a dynamite year.
Well, I would like to think someone will win the X Prize. And I think our general presumption is that it'll be BERT, but I think it almost doesn't matter. As we were chatting during one of the breaks here, I think the fact that a vehicle, the size that vehicle was, and for the cost that they're talking about, I think it almost doesn't matter where in the world that vehicle comes from and, you know, what happens. I think just the fact that it happened at all is the big impact. And so, you know, certainly we would like to get a couple or three companies working in Frederick. We would like to have some relationships, some longer term relationships with some big sponsors, and you know, we're certainly looking at that. Anyway, I don't know if I mentioned this, but July 4th in Frederick, we are going to do Beyond Earth is going to do a launch, weather and flight clearance and all those other things permitting. So if any of you are, those of you calling in from Texas, pile in your car, and they have very good pecan pie, too. You will not go hungry at the Frederick 4th of July celebration. So
to put Frederick in perspective, if you're in Dallas, what is that, about a three-hour drive?
Two or three. It's sort of equidistant between Dallas and Amarillo and Oklahoma City. It's a little, if you're going to fly in, I usually fly into Oklahoma City because it's a little closer. So it's in that triangle there. The nearest city of any size is Lawton, about 45 miles to the northeast.
Okay, so it's actually an easy drive if you are in that Dallas region of Texas to get to Frederick. You could even do it in a one-day trip, probably.
Oh, you could do it as a day trip, no problem. Yeah, I mean, if you stuck around for the fireworks in the evening and all that stuff, you know, you get home late. But hey, that's what 4th of July is for, right?
You know, absolutely. Now, if you're in Houston or San Antonio, it's going to be much further.
Yeah, that's kind of. But Dallas is distinctly a good day trip, and our globalspaceweek.org website has a link to all the festivities that are happening there. We're going to have a super top secret rocket scientist only area for kids, where they'll learn to. We're going to teach them Morse code so that they'll be able to tell each other secrets and. Have them make what we're calling Substance AS rockets, which are powered by that top-secret substance Alka-Seltzer and things like that. And so we're going to let them get out there. And Beyond Earth is going to fly a teddy bear who, with great fanfare in my capacity as executive director of Global Space League, I'm going to pin Baronaut wings on him. And you qualify for Baronaut wings by flying on a rocket higher than a kid can toss you. So there you go.
Pretty good, pretty good. And they just show up and go to that area, is that correct?
Yeah, they're charging a few bucks to park or something. But it's Lake Frederick, which is to the northeast. And again, we have the link to the Frederick Chamber site, which has all the details.
Are there any plans for something like a space camp or a space summer school for kids or even high school kids, you know, in this Frederick development?
What we're trying to do is have this be relatively decentralized so it can grow. And we're looking at some relationships with museums and things like that. As I said, we're in the wake of all this on Monday, looking at a variety of different models to expand this beyond schools. And as those things evolve, they'll be on our website.
Okay, and do you want to give out those URLs? Again, we are getting close to the end of the show. I should have had you do that much earlier.
Right. Our Global Space League website is www.globalspaceleague.org.
And Takeoff is what is that?
Takeoff is my for-profit consulting company, and that's takeofftech.com, TakeoffTech.com.
For 2005, we'll have a new president, whoever he may be, and you know, we'll have a fresh outlook, even if President Bush gets reelected. It'll still be a fresh start for the next 4 years. Do you think we will continue with a commitment to realizing the Aldrich Plan recommendations? What do you think 2005 and the immediate future after that portends for the commercial space world?
Well, a lot of it will depend on whether they succeed with return to flight.
Now you're talking about the shuttle and
the
getting...
The shuttle, yeah.
Okay.
If not, you know, I don't know what they're going to do. And, you know, so, you know, the manned program is a very, very large part of NASA. And if they continue to have issues, you know, I think that will dominate the governmental folks for a while. And how we can come in there and, you know, and attempt to save their bacon, I don't know. And that's one of the reasons we're trying to talk to working-level scientists to take on things that are a scale we can understand and see if we can help them out.
On the policy level, how willing do you think our government will be down the road if we don't return to flight to continue to buy rides from the Russians, possibly the Europeans, on a manned version of the Ariane, which it is man-certified, and maybe even down the road the Chinese? Do you think we're willing to commit to a manned program if we have to buy rides from these sources?
Well, it would certainly be an interesting discussion in Congress, I imagine, you know, in many ways. I've been pushing in various circles to allow scientists with government money to request a ride on any vehicle that has gotten an ASD license. Because one of the issues has been, right now, if you're proposing to a program that involves a launch, you're not handed money to buy a launch, you're handed a launch. And so there needs to be some way that PIs, principal investigators on proposals, can actually get in there and kick a little bit. And one quantifiable way I suggested is, well, you know, if somebody's gotten a launch license, you know, the FAA has looked at them. The FAA has no jurisdiction over government launch vehicles, but that would seem to me a pretty decent, you know, good housekeeping seal of approval that AST approved them to launch at least once so far. So I've been pushing that in various quadrants, and, you know, and everybody nods and says that's really interesting, but I don't know if we'll get anywhere with that.
Here's an interesting comment question on email from Dave, and I know him, so I know his background. He didn't say his background, so I'm reluctant to say it on air, but let's just say he's an extremely well-connected person in the public space arena. And he says we need, as a community, to intentionally focus on preparing the public for an eventual private manned flight accident, and even more, get some Beltway talking heads type folks, the types that might be called upon for commentary by the networks the day of an accident, for example. We need to get them primed and ready for that event when it unfortunately happens, so that we hit the airways first with intelligent analysis of risk acceptance by those involved, rather than leave the field open to all that will shut them down or the congressional critters who will otherwise jump into the vacuum to fill the void. So Dave is assuming that there eventually will be a private sector manned spaceflight tragic accident. And then he goes on and says the first days after the first accident will be critical and we need to be prepared beforehand. Do you have any thoughts on what Dave is saying?
I agree. I don't know right now where we're trying to build up. We can do this if we really want to say that so early. You know, it's an interesting balance. Clearly folks that are sympathetic to us and who understand that risk, as we've been saying, that risk is a part of this, you know, might be encouraged to think about that and to make themselves available to the media. But on the other hand, you know, if you're doing a first walkthrough when you're selling a house, you don't point out the termites right away. And, you know, we're still in a selling mode, and so it's tough.
Just for the listeners to know, when one of these companies like Spaceship One or X-Corps or one of the others gets a launch license from AST, part of what is required is to come forward with an accident plan of what you're going to do when you or if you do have the kind of accident that our emailer Dave has suggested. And if that plan is comprehensive and to the point, it will include who is going to be a spokesperson and how they're going to get to the media and the press. Now, the AST doesn't require that part, but that's just common sense, proper business management, that those components be in that accident and accident investigation plan if such an event does happen. So, and hopefully it won't happen, but the early days of aviation certainly had their risk and accidents, and I would suspect that space is not going to be that much different from the early days of aviation. So we'll hope for the best, right?
Well, it's about when you're a little business, about all you can do is look around and say, that's a wave, and I better paddle like heck and see if I can get up on my surfboard on top of it.
You know, absolutely. And, you know, I know the people involved in these companies, and they are really going the extra mile for safety and redundant systems, and, you know, my perception is they're doing an excellent job, and they're quite conscious and quite aware of the issues, not just from the personal safety point of view, but from the issues that Dave has brought up. I do not at all see anyone ignoring the realities that Dave is talking about, and I think that's very encouraging. So, and that's probably been your experience as well when you talk to these people.
Well, I mean, if there are folks that are putting pilots in these things, these are tiny companies, and the pilots are not, you know, Hertz Rent-A-Pilots here. I mean, they're friends. And I think everybody's very conscious that if anything happens, that they're going to be emotionally distraught themselves. And you know, and hopefully everybody has thought through what happens if that happens.
We are now really coming up on the end of the show. Time just goes so fast. What would you like to leave with the listeners today as thoughts for what you're doing, what you believe to be the important focus that we should be paying attention to, pearls of wisdom for the kind of activities that we're all excited about that have been happening and for our future? What's your message to our listeners today?
I think the bottom line, and presumably a lot of folks listening are space entrepreneurs, is start to work together. This is an industry where people have not worked together well traditionally in the past. There's been a lot of rivalry. We're starting to win. Look at your company and see if maybe there's one place you're very, very strong, and maybe somebody else is very strong on something else, and think about collaborating, because it's, you know, it takes a village, and we're going to win this if we all start working together.
And when you say we all start working together, are you talking about the various companies and organizations in America, or are you talking globally?
Well, at the moment, unfortunately, it has to be America until something happens to make it easier to collaborate globally. And so I guess that's a two-part answer from that perspective.
If you had the perfect world, it would be globally. Is that correct?
If I had the perfect world, I mean, that's how traditionally science has moved forward. And I think in due course, we're going to have to do something to all work together worldwide.
Absolutely, because I know the impact of Spaceship One was felt around the world. I mean, I was getting messages from Greece and Australia and Japan and from all of the European countries and Canada, and this was anything but a strictly an American event. I mean, it touched people globally around the world. It was an incredible experience fielding this feedback coming in from people who were listening and wanting to know more about Bert's flight. And so I just hope a lot of people in Congress were paying attention and will pay attention and will make the prudent votes when it comes time to vote on key issues that affect space commerce and returning to flight and space exploration, because it's a valuable asset and program for our country and our economy. So, Joan, that pretty much brings us to the end of today's program. And when they do the XPRIZE flight with Spaceship One, are you planning to go back?
Well, that's the plan. And I still can't believe I got to stand next to that runway for this flight, and I wouldn't miss it.
So you would do the 3 a.m. trains and the whole bit again to go back when he goes for the XPRIZE?
Well, I'm going to bring earplugs this time.
Will you go back for both flights or just for the initial one, assuming the initial one is successful?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of it will depend on my own schedule. You know, if I need to be in Frederick for a launch, I'll take precedence because, you know, we're responsible for those. And, you know, we'll just play it by ear.
Well, I'm excited about it and waiting for it to happen. And I'm looking forward to covering it again. And it's just been a phenomenal adventure. And when 2004 started, I didn't think that it would be this exciting in the private space field by the middle of June. And it is on fire. And it is exciting. And that is for sure. And efforts that you're doing and opening up Frederick and doing the kind of things that you're doing are certainly adding to the excitement.
All right. Well, you need to come on down and have some pecan pie in Frederick.
Well, maybe I'll do it during the football season when I can catch a Sooner game as well.
There you go.
So we'll combine it with something else, too. So I want to take this opportunity to thank you very much for being a guest on the Space Show. I look forward to having you back in the future when you have more news to report to us and to update us with. You're always welcome. And Space Show listeners, come back on Tuesday for another Space Show and look for that newsletter. It will give you the information on when the Mojave program is updated and archived. So on behalf of my guest, Joan Horvath, and myself, a great week to all of you, and thank you for listening to The Space Show. Goodbye.